Farewell, I'm Bound to Leave You, new fiction from writer Fred Chappell, next on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Welcome to the Center's weekly radio magazine about books and ideas. Soundings is made possible by funding from TIAA CREF, providing financial services exclusively for people employed in education and research, offering pension, tax-deferred investment, and insurance products. Fred Chappell is the author of more than 20 books of fiction and poetry. His new novel is Farewell, I'm Bound to Leave You. Like much of his work, it's set in the mountains of North Carolina, a story about family and memory. With an excerpt from his new novel, here is Fred Chappell.
In the valleys, after the sun rolls behind the hills and just before the sky turns gray and the little brown birds seek their bushes, there's a period of violet light eerie in its effects. The jonquils yellow and the dogwood's whiteness become almost vocal in the intensities of their colors, and the sides of the hills and buildings lose definition of surface and become softer in aspect. You feel that if you put your hand against the ground or against an outside wall, you would touch not hardness but cloudiness. It would be as if you had discovered the world as it underwent change, all things shaping differently as they readied themselves to receive the nighttime.
Writer Fred Chappell, his new novel is Farewell, I'm Bound to Leave You. As the book opens, a grandmother lies dying at home in the mountains of North Carolina. Her daughter keeps watch. In the next room, her grandson, a youngster named Jess Kirkman, recalls the stories his mother and grandmother have given him in preparation for his own life. These are stories that celebrate the lives of strong and vibrant women, from the feistiest woman to the silent woman to the shining woman and the remembering woman. Fred Chappell teaches at the University of North Carolina at Greensboro.
This is the tale with four tellers. My grandmother told it to me a number of times, and at other times my mother gave the account in very different terms. Sometimes they would talk about it simultaneously, shooting each other puzzled or affirming glances as they ranged from point to point. Most importantly, it is a story told in the words and thoughts of a famous man named Holm Barcroft. And now I set it down on paper for my sister Mitzi to read at her leisure some day and maybe pass on to her children. It is a strange story of the most ordinary happenings, and it might be difficult to understand why my mother and grandmother returned to it so often, sometimes touching it only lightly, but at other times piercing it deeply, like hummingbirds at the blossoms of a trumpet vine. I think its attraction for them lay in the figure of Barcroft, the celebrated musicologist and folklorist. He was striking and romantic, and I believe he captivated their hearts, although my mother was only 8 years old at the time, and my grandmother a proud matron in her 40th year, with two children living and one dead. I also think they liked to tell it because it showed the kind of people we were in our mountains, the way we would like for others to know us, and because it was a story that celebrated their friends the Laffertys, a family I knew only by reputation. Perhaps there were other reasons, too. Stories have 100 motives and 1,000 sources, some as recognizable as tiger lilies, some as hidden as secret mountaintop springs. At any rate, I hear it in my own memory as a kind of music, its themes rendered in the measured tones of my grandmother, like a viola singing, and accompanied by the clear pipings of my mother remembering herself as an awestruck child, the warbling of clarinet arpeggios. Dr. Holm Barcroft's story is present as a grave cello ostinato that in the end takes the dominant melody. It is this music I would like to render here, as if I put supporting chords to stave paper. The fourth voice is my own, as I try to harmonize the sounds in my head. Together, we are a quartet. Soprano, alto, tenor, baritone.
Oh, Shenandoah, I long to see you. Oh, across the wide Missouri. Oh, Valley Green, I am your daughter. Oh, your rolling river, forevermore your faithful daughter.
Fred Chappell, welcome to the National Humanities Center.
Thank you, Wayne. It's good to be here. I appreciate being asked.
Well, congratulations on this marvelous book, Farewell, I'm Bound to Leave You. Tell us about the title.
The title comes from a very famous American folk song, O Shenandoah. I think it's one of the later verses in the song that goes, and so farewell, I'm bound to leave you. All away, you rolling river, I'll be gone when dawn is breaking. Away, away, across the wide Missouri.
Whose voices do we hear in this book?
You hear the voices of the women of the mountains of western North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
The framework of the book is that the grandmother of Jess Kirkman, a young man, 15 years of age, is dying in the back of her own house while her daughter, his mother Cora, keeps watch with her. But the men, Jess and his father, have been banished from the bedroom. Uh-huh. The mother wants to spend her last hours with the grandmother alone, that is her mother alone. And as Jess and his father sit in another room, keeping their own sorrowful watch, Jess remembers the stories that his mother and grandmother told him over the years as they prepared him to meet the world of women, which he's just about to enter into.
This book is about time, and it's about stories. It is impossible, Fred, to summarize for our listeners the incredible variety of voices and tales and nuggets and anecdotes that you pack into this wonderful novel. But give us a sense of who these voices are and how they speak to this young man.
The women in Jess's family, his mother and grandmother, are particularly admiring of strong-spirited women, women of character and strength of purpose and women who are a little idiosyncratic in certain ways. And they want Jess to learn to admire this kind of women, too, and not other kinds of girls that they wouldn't approve of, empty vessels, as the grandmother might say. So that's why they tell him these particular stories, so that he will learn to admire the courage and endurance of women, as well as their good looks and modest demeanor.
Now, I can hear a literary critic, Fred, saying, well, this is proto-feminism. You tell us about that.
I have no political agenda whatsoever. I am not. I'm in favor of everybody having whatever rights they can grab hold of and keep on to,
right.
But I ain't no feminist, and I ain't no nothing. I'm just a writer.
Are you Jess Kirkman? Let's put it that way. The assembling, the understanding of these narrative voices and the stories they tell. How'd that work?
Well, a long time ago, I could have told you very clearly that I was not Jess Kirkman, but after writing about this character since 1971, I'm not quite so sure now.
This is actually the third book, if I got this right, in a sequence of novels that extends across time and space in our mountains of North Carolina.
Yes, sir, this is the third novel in a projected quartet. But also these characters under different names appear in a quartet of poetry volumes, which have been collected together under the title Midquest. But it was a project conceived originally as an octave of books, eight books, four books of poetry, four novels, and the novels would comment on the poetry and provide a regional and intellectual backdrop for the poetry.
Now, Fred, I mean no disrespect, but I've got to tell you, for somebody who's giving us this sense of, gee willikers, I'm just an Andy Griffith kind of guy, there is a lot of sophisticated work going on in these books of poetry and in these novels, for example, the musical way that you, music as an organizing principle. Tell us about that.
That's true, but it's a firm tenet of my belief, Wayne, that folk art is just as sophisticated as the most highest and most cosmopolitan kind of art. Mm-hmm. And what I've tried to uncover in these books, especially the poetry, is that fact that folk art has its own sophisticated rules and that you have to know what you're doing. And I wanted to bring these to light. In fact, my model for these tales and the poems was not a literary one, but the paintings of Marc Chagall, his paintings of village life that incorporate all kinds of fantasy elements and all kinds of color, all kinds of playfulness, and at the same time strike, for all their fantastic surface, strike the deepest chords for those people who are familiar with this.
Does that make of you a scholar who's a novelist who's a poet, or a poet who's a novelist who's a scholar? How does that, what's the hierarchy?
It just makes me somebody who's trying to figure out what in the world he's doing, Wayne. I don't try to claim any real pretension to this sort of thing. I know what I wanted to do, and I used every means I could to bring it about. When you mentioned the theme of music, which runs through all the books, the concluding section of this book is actually drawn after or suggested by Matisse's great fresco, which we saw in Paris not long ago, The Dance, those figures dancing round in a ring, which for him and for a great many others is a kind of symbol for the continuity of the universe.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I wanted to show, that the music goes on beneath human lives and draws all of us, young, old, one culture and another, together.
Let's talk about some of these people. The book, Fred Chappell, is Farewell, I'm Bound to Leave You. Tell our listeners about the figuring woman.
The figuring woman is named Aunt Shirley Howes in this volume.
That's a great name, great name.
Well, it's obviously a pun on Sherlock Holmes. When I designed the book, when I was designing the book, I figured since these are stories told by women about women, they should be the most traditional kinds of stories we know. And to that end, I included in the book all the most traditional stories we have, and as forms. We have a ghost story, we have a courtship story,
right.
We have a detective story, we have a saint's legend, which is very odd.
Absolutely.
We even have a fish story. and I thought, since women are, as far as I'm concerned, repositories, especially of mountain culture, they should be telling very traditional tales.
So Aunt Shirley is the one that everybody sort of in the family and in the culture, when you got a problem and you can't figure out what's going on, you go to Aunt Shirley, and she is the proper term, ciphers it?
That's right.
She puts it together. Tell us quickly about the experience that she has with a young woman who's in love and who doesn't want to tell her parents who she's in love with. And there's a kind of a mystery involved here. It's a big order, but see if you can give us this quickly.
Yes, the young lady does not wish to tell her parents which suitor she favors, because she understands immediately that her father, never wanting her to get married at all and
right,
leave home,
right,
will be against, which he will disfavor any suitor that she chooses.
Mm-hmm. And one of them's a big, rough mountain kid, and the other one's sort of a wiry little guy, and we have to wait until the end to find out, don't we?
Yes, we do, and then we have to, after we found out, we have to wait and find out how Aunt Shirley figured which one it was.
Well, how does she? There's a sort of an escape here and an elopement.
It's an elopement.
That's right. And how does Aunt Shirley put that together?
Oh, she watches the signs. She listens for clues. She observes the psychology of the people involved, and she understands that in the spring of the year, the houses in the mountains, the ground before them thaws before the ground in back of them, which stays frozen. And that turns out to be an important thing upon which the the story, which was originally called Southern Exposure, turns.
This is somebody who simply, maybe she's a witch, maybe she's supernatural, but she simply looks and sees what's in front of her and figures things out.
No, she's not supernatural in the least. She's a very rational, deductive kind of woman. She's a traditional figure, the wise woman of the village. I chose her as that kind of figure, and I thought I'd bring her up to date by making her a detective, actually more in the line of Nero Wolfe, that is the armchair detective, rather than Sherlock Holmes.
That's right. She doesn't get out that much. Well, at the other end, if Aunt Shirley represents, as you say, not the supernatural, but the rational, at the other end, we've got The Shining Woman. This sounds like a Tony Hillerman novel. Tell us about The Shining Woman here.
The Shining Woman is the ghost story, and I thought it would be fun to have the rational figure in the novel, Aunt Shirley, figure out the irrational processes of ghosts. And she is able to help this family, which is afflicted by the haint, as it's called where I come from, to figure out the motives and origin of this haint, and finally
to us flatlanders, that's a haunting.
That you would say haunt, yes.
Right.
Actually, where I come from, there are two different pronunciations. Haint, I've heard a great deal, but also haint, as in ain't, and it depends where you happen to land.
Well,
what holler you wander into?
I sidetracked you, Fred. Tell it. Who is the Shining Woman, and what role does she play in this episode in your book?
She's the ghost of another woman who suffered not a dreadful fate, a fate all too ordinary, but a fate that she comes back to warn a second wife.
And this would be Little Mary. Have I got that right?
I think so.
and what message does the ghost communicate to the second wife?
That her husband had better offer her some joy in this life. Mm-hmm. That this life is not all root hog or die. If it is, it's no better than whatever purgatory one might wander into after death. She comes back to bring her glad tidings that there is a flower on the hillside and a sun in the sky.
Uh-huh. Fred Chappell, your book is it's called Farewell, I'm Bound to Leave You. Tell us about I'm losing track here of the characters and the episodes, but the woman who is a first-rate cook, she knows how to shoot, she's stronger than all the men put together, and she takes offense in the courtship, and she challenges her suitor, a man now that she used to fight with when she was a girl, and sort of puts him on the right track. Speaking again of strong women, tell us about that episode.
Yes, she's called in the book the feistiest woman. Uh-huh. Her name is Ginger Summerall, and she does take umbrage at her suitor, for, as the famous folk song says, for courting too slow. Comes from a song called On Top of Old Smoky.
Yeah, well, she initiates the courtship after a fashion.
She does indeed initiate the courtship because the other men, seeing the kind of martial spirit she evinces at times, are rather frightened of her. So she picks out from this group of men in this little hamlet in the remote part of the mountains the one who seems to her educable, a man with enough spirit that he can be brought along. But at one point, he's not brought along fast enough, and she's
got to whip him into shape.
Huh? Yeah, she's got to. She conceives that she's been insulted.
So she challenges him.
Sure.
Knives, rifles, guns, rocks. My goodness.
Her honor has been besmirched, and she will. She will defend it for herself.
All right, and tell us how this story has a bit of a happy ending. Tell us how this turns out.
Well, not to give anything away, but it does have a happy ending. The duel does take place. But they wreak no violence upon each other, and as far as I can tell, they're going to live happily ever after, at least until his early death, which is a sad story not told in the book.
Well, there are a number of untold stories in this book, aren't there, Fred? There are hints that you have these narrators drop. Well, that's another story, and we'll come back to that. And I congratulate you. It intrigues us. It reminds us of the nature of what we're listening to. It gets us looking forward to the next book or the next set of poems. Am I right?
That's part of the strategy, of course.
Uh-huh.
But also, that seems to me the way storytellers do. That's the way I've heard storytellers talk all my life.
Mm-hmm.
I conceived of the book sometimes visually as a tapestry book. That is, lots of stories, and they're woven together. But if you go around back of a tapestry, you'll see a lot of threads hanging down that don't go anywhere, don't seem to go anywhere,
right,
that are necessary to be there because they hold the others together. So every once in a while, I would flip over to the other side of the tapestry and show people what the pattern was from behind.
Again, the book, Fred, is Farewell, I'm Bound to Leave You. Much of the narrative power in these stories, these wonderful anecdotes of the mountains of North Carolina, much of the weight and the pleasure of these stories comes to rest in the figure again of this young man, Jess Kirkman, a 15-year-old boy. What effect do you want these stories, the voices of women, to have on him as a sort of an organizing presence, and then again on your readers as they go through this?
I hope that Jess will come to some just appreciation of women. These books of coming in, or the first novel in this series called I Am One of You Forever, mm-hmm, is a story about the whole family, and Jess observes those events, almost all those events, for himself. The second novel, Right in the Corner Where You Are, concerns a famous day in his father's career as a school teacher, which didn't last very long, but there it was, and he would have heard about that by rumor. But this one, I wanted to a novel in which Jess was taught directly, that he was being shaped toward purposes, toward ends that he would not recognize at the time, but later on would be appreciative of, would be grateful for. And that was my purpose here. I wanted to draw a young man who comes without knowing exactly why to what might be a proper appreciation of the gentler half of the human race.
Fred, who are the important formative women in your life?
My mother, my grandmother, and my wife, probably above all.
Mm-hmm.
And then,
do they talk like the women in these books, in this book?
My grandmother talked a little bit like the grandmother in this book. My mother talked a little bit like the mother in this book, and my wife talks in her own strange tone.
And again, what effect do you want this kind of these wonderful stories and these narrative voices? How do they work out there in this mass culture that we inhabit? This is the age of Michael Jackson and Michael Jordan and Madonna, and goodness knows the kind of thing that you do just doesn't circulate as widely as we both might hope. What do you want it to do out there?
Oh, I just want it to be there. I just want it to exist so that if anybody ever has a opportunity or the curiosity to find out about folks who mm-hmm. lived in the mountains of Western North Carolina during a certain period of time, the books will be available for them to go to. I have no ambition to be a mass circulation writer of any sort. If I'd wanted money, I would have stayed in the furniture business.
you are from that part of the state, huh?
My father had a retail furniture business, and, mm-hmm. and it was rather a sore point, but between us, that I did not take up the family business.
Well, let's put it this way, Fred Chappell. You have created things that, what shall we call them, furnishings of the mind, where people can sit and think thoughts that we don't invite all the time. I mean, some of this stuff makes us uncomfortable. We have to think about the way families work and the way men and women interact and how parents how they live their lives with their kids and then pass it on.
Yes, it's not a real work of literature if it merely props up your prejudices and superstitions that you have already. One of the purposes of literature is to disturb as well as to affirm. So if there are no shadows in a work, then you wouldn't see the light in it either.
Uh-huh. Oh, my goodness. You sound like my hero, Nathaniel Hawthorne.
Well, one of mine, too, as a matter of fact. The one horror novel I ever wrote, I think I owed a Hawthorne more than anyone else.
We will save that, Fred Chappell, for another recording session. I want to thank you so much for coming to the National Humanities Center. You are Fred Chappell. You teach at UNC Greensboro, and this wonderful new book is called Farewell, I'm Bound to Leave You. It's available from Picador. Fred, thank you. I certainly wish you well in your work.
Thank you, Wayne. It was grand to be here, and I wish you good luck, too.
You're listening to Soundings, a radio magazine about books and ideas from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. My guest this week was writer Fred Chappell. Soundings is made possible by funding from TIAA CREF, providing financial services exclusively for people employed in education and research, offering pension, tax-deferred investment, and insurance products. I'll be back in just a moment with information about where to write for an audio tape of this program.
Oh, Shenandoah, I long to see you. Away, my heart's away. Cross the
It's Soundings from the National Humanities Center. For an audio cassette, call us at 919-549-0661 or send $10 to Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. Our zip code is 27709. This week, it's program number 861. Our email address is sounding, S-O-U-N-D-I-N-G, at ga.unc.edu. Visit our site on the World Wide Web at www.nhc.rtp.nc.us/8080. Next week on Soundings, Dixie Rising. New York Times correspondent Peter Applebaum will be here to talk about his new book, Dixie Rising, How the South is Shaping American Values, Politics, and Culture. Finally, a program note. A few cabins remain on the National Humanities Center study session to the Greek islands and Turkey aboard the exclusively chartered four-masted yacht Sea Cloud. Information provided 1-888-650-TOUR, 1-888-650-8687. Until next week's show, thanks for listening to Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond. Our theme music is by Jeff Perry. Soundings is a cultural affairs radio service of the National Humanities Center.